Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're wondering, why would you read a manuscript? It's not often that you get your hands on a manuscript, of course, whether it's the first draft of a novel or an ancient text etched on thick vellum. On the show today, we're going to be getting to know stories in their original formats and discovering what can be learnt by experiencing them firsthand. We'll be going from Cambridge University to the desk of an editor of fiction, and we'll learn about a publisher in Paris who's printing the handwritten originals of classic tales. Join me then as we peer into the mind of the writer and the history of the book itself on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We're going to begin today's show at Cambridge University, and more specifically in the Corpus Christi campus's Parker Library. This is the home of around 600 manuscripts and rare books collected in the 16th century, including some of the oldest in England, from original Chaucer's to texts that were once owned by saints and kings and that tell the histories of music, language, religion, politics and art. The library's resident expert is fellow librarian Christopher de Hamel, and you'd be hard-pressed to find a more passionate voice on the subject of old books. De Hamel has just published a brand new book himself, Meetings with Remarkable Manuscripts, where he relives moments through his long career discovering and reading these ancient texts around the world that have particularly stood out. Producer Holly headed to the Parker Library to talk to Christopher de Hamel about the romance of discovering these books and the stories they can tell beyond what's written on the page.
This is the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. That's the first piece of sustained English prose, the oldest known copy of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, began in the 9th century for King Alfred. This is the Old English translation of Bede, the other great English text. This is King Athelstan's copy of the life of St. Cuthbert, the original patron saint of England. This is the Winchester Troper, little tiny book, but it's the earliest record in Europe of polyphonic music. These are books, this is literature, this is writing, this is art from the Middle Ages. Everything that we know about classical and medieval history and literature and religion and learning and culture and music and art is conveyed through the medium of manuscripts. So for about 1,500 years in Europe, every single book, everything written down was written down by hand. So these are the oldest books we have, and they exist in huge numbers. They're not rare, and they're often absolutely fantastic.
You liken meeting a manuscript to meeting a famous person. What sort of feeling do you get when you finally get a manuscript that you've been wanting to see in your hands?
Well, you mentioned this parallel with meeting a famous person. We sort of all pretend that all people are the same, but there's no doubt there is a slight kick when you find yourself shaking hands with a figure of world stature, and I haven't done that very often. You know about some great object, some great place, and you find yourself there and you can't believe that you, just ordinary someone like yourself, is actually literally face to face with something like the Book of Kells or the Très Richeur, the Duc de Berry. It is an extraordinary feeling that this object of immense importance in cultural history is absolutely right there on the table in front of you. And even more than, say, standing in front of a famous painting or looking at a famous building, these are movable, tactile objects. You turn the pages of a manuscript, you're actually touching it. You really are. It's moving around. You turn from one page to another, the gold sparkles, and you really have at that moment, you have a kind of personal connection with it, which I find very exciting. I still do.
And there must be something in actually, you know, touching the physical thing, the weight, the pages, the seeing the ink on the page. And how does that change how you read into the book itself? Seeing, you know, the rips in the page, perhaps the blotting of the ink, that sort of thing.
We are sitting at the moment in a library where we have digitized every single page of every manuscript. Over 200,000 images of manuscripts here are available free on the internet, and I can tell you why that's a good idea. But it is not the same as having the real thing in front of you. And it's rather like, why should any of us want to go and look at the Mona Lisa or the Taj Mahal? We've all seen photographs of it, but it's not the same as that experience of actually confronting it. And no photograph, no digitized facsimile, no microfilm is really a substitute for having the thing in front of you. And there is no doubt that as you look at it, you will start to notice things that probably no one has ever seen before. You'll notice as you turn the pages that there are pictures have been rubbed out and altered and changed, and things have gone wrong, and something's been corrected, and something's been scratched on, or suddenly you may discover there's a leaf missing that no one has ever noticed, or, and you will come up with things. Now, sometimes it doesn't matter. Or you make some extraordinary discovery and you want to rush around to everyone and say, look at this, and they think, well, who cares? But I think there is a kind of thrill in looking at, these are human objects, they're made by people, entirely handmade. And as you look at it and turn it over and over and get it against the light and, as you say, feel the weight of it in your hands, you smell the parchment, you hear it kind of crackling as you turn the page, you are almost coming into contact with the people who made it and used it and read it, and you don't even know what you're looking for. I want to know everything about a manuscript. I want to know who made it and when and why and where and how and where it's been and how long it took and who did it and what it cost and why it has pictures and where they come from and how it was read and how it was used and shelved and survived, and all that kind of evidence you can often see by looking at a handmade object. Like people, every manuscript is different. Everyone has its story to tell. And although in this particular book we're looking at a dozen really very, very grand manuscripts at the real top end, we could have made it just as fascinating by meetings with 12 really boring, really slight manuscripts. They too have their stories.
One of the interesting things that's almost as interesting as what's inside the books is where they have ended up and the hands they've passed through. Are there any particular stories of the journey of some of these manuscripts that really stand out for you?
Books, more than almost any other artefact, have passed from hand to hand to hand through the ages. These are not archaeological objects. It's not like some Egyptian tomb which is discovered in the 20th century and everything comes from the ancient world into now. These have always belonged to people. And people tend to write their names in books much more than they do on any other thing. And each manuscript is different from every other one. So old catalogues, inventories, wills, descriptions, you can quite often identify a manuscript. And how these books have survived through the Middle Ages, I mean from the Middle Ages to now, can be part of an adventure as they move around the world. Of the dozen books described there, I realised when I got to the end that only one of them is actually now in the country in which it was originally made. All the others have moved around. So there's an Italian manuscript there that ended up in Russia. There's a Spanish manuscript that went through France into and England into America. There's an English manuscript that was taken out of England in the early 8th century and is still in Italy where it ended up, and so on. And they kind of move around. They're very portable things. And these journeys and adventures are part of the fun of it. The one I mentioned, which is in France, had quite a lot of its adventures outside France. It was in England in the early 15th century. It was in England in the 19th century. It was back in France in the early 20th century. It was stolen by the Nazis during the war by Hermann Göring and then was recovered from Berchtesgaden at the end of the war in South Germany and came back to France. So it's not had a simple life. And like people, the stories they have to tell are, to me, fascinating.
And how about your own adventures? I mean, I don't know if you've had any adventures quite as much as that. That's quite an extraordinary journey. But you've been, you know, all around the world looking for these texts. What sort of places have these taken you to? What sort of journeys have you been on? Because one of the nice things about your book is, you know, reading about how you finish university and then you're camping, going around Europe camping, and then going to these sort of labyrinthine libraries. And you describe the journeys through the libraries very beautifully. What sort of places has it taken you to?
Well, I love looking at manuscripts and I love visiting libraries. And if you find yourself in an exotic place, it's often rather fun to go around to the local library and see what they've got. My little trick there is, if you turn up at a library and say, I want to see your best manuscripts, they're not going to let you in. But if you go first to the postcard shop, this is the thing. Look at the postcards, you see, and memorize a couple of numbers. You then say, I'd like to see manuscript 69 and manuscript 142, and they think you know what you're talking about. I also spent most of my working life working for Sotheby's, cataloguing medieval manuscripts, and inevitably, in the course of that job, we travelled around a huge amount. So I was looking at manuscripts in, well, it was part of my job, throughout Europe and America. Most European medieval manuscripts are likely to be in libraries in Europe or America, but there are also manuscripts in Australasia, South America, Japan, South Africa, South America, and so on. And I always long to know what they've got. What's in them, what they actually say, is in some ways not even essential. You can enjoy a manuscript you can't read. I mean, I can actually read Latin and Anglo-Norman, the two languages used here. And there is a certain excitement about suddenly finding you read a sentence or read a page of something that's 650 years old. But there are a million things you can do with a book without necessarily reading it, and how it was made and how it was designed and what's in it and why it has pictures and what they're copied from, who did them and who they were and how many different hands are involved and how many scribes and how they correct them and how they change it and how you can see them designing it and altering it. And at the beginning here, something clearly went badly wrong. They were making one of these pages. This is a duplicate of one of the pages which occurs inside the book. And you can see the scribe writes first and he's left spaces for the miniatures. But he's made so many mistakes on it, he's pulled the page out and started again. And that kind of human disentanglement of what they're doing is part of the fun of it.
Are there any manuscripts that you have your heart set on to go and handle next, or have you seen every manuscript you could possibly ever want to see by now?
There are one or two things I'd quite like to find, and if I had to name an example, I would say that what I think is probably the greatest medieval illuminated manuscript made in England is the Winchester Bible, a 12th century Bible, still in Winchester Cathedral, painted with the most astonishing paintings, absolutely fantastic. And sometime in its history, about a dozen of its pictures were cut out. They can't all have been destroyed. I'd love to find one. I think that's the one thing I'd really like to do more than anything else, is find a missing initial from the Winchester Bible.
That was Christopher de Hamel, and his book Meetings with Remarkable Manuscripts is out now, published by Alan Lane. Over time, the word manuscript has changed meaning. It's from the Latin manuscriptus, handwritten. But the word now often refers to the first draft of a book that you might send to a publisher. But these are rarely penned by hand anymore, of course. Walter Donohue is a senior editor at Faber & Faber. He's well-versed in the handling of modern manuscripts from established authors and exciting new ones too. And he tells me what it's like to have the heavy thump of a new text land on his desk.
If it's too heavy, then it's probably not such a thrill. But because the new Paul Auster novel arrived and was 320,000 words, so that was a thump. But it's a masterpiece, so that's okay. But I think it's harder when it's a first-time novelist, because quite often their novels tend to be too long. But you can't kind of prejudge it. You know, you just, even if it's too long, what you look at when you read the manuscript is what's there, what's the potential, what's the vision of the writer. And then if you think that it's worth publishing, then you work with the writer to kind of trim it down to size. The danger with a first-time novelist, first-time filmmaker, is that they want to throw everything.
This is everything I've thought about the world in the last, say, 39 years.
Yes, exactly.
Onto the page.
But then you understand that, and that's how you proceed. The thing is to just find the vision behind the book, which comes through the voice of the book. And I think the hardest part, if you're a writer, is the beginning of the book, the first sentence, and what the end is. And if you kind of can crack those two things, what's in the middle probably will work.
Once you sorted the North and the South Pole, maybe the rest of the world forms itself.
Yeah, because if you create the right moment to begin a story and the end of that story works, then you have such a firm grounding that whatever the kind of problems in the middle, you actually know where you're going. And I think the problem with a lot of writers is that they want every page to be perfect. And that's why it takes them years to write the novel. And in fact, a novel should be written very quickly. Yeah. Once you got the opening sentence, once you know what the voice is, then just move through as quickly as you can. Because when you get to the end, you can finally step back and look and say, oh, is this what I've created? I thought I was doing a mountain, but I made a tree.
Yeah.
But actually, I liked what the tree is, and that's kind of what I wanted to do. And then writing is really about rewriting. You just go through it once, you go through it again. Each time you go through it, you know, you're hewing away at the block of wood, and then you can see what it is. But if you don't have the block of wood, if you only have little bits, it's very easy to lose your way.
I was going to say, I suppose that's maybe the problem with lots of first-time novelists, maybe is having lots of intricately carved bits of wood that are perfect, little examples of writing and ideals, maybe of story, maybe of character or dialogue, sparkling set pieces, but they don't make a sculpture all on their own. And before I know you've got some examples of endings and beginnings in front of you, Walter, but before that, To go back to the physical idea of the manuscript, is that still how things are delivered to you as an editor? Is it a sort of loose-bound collection of A4 pages? What is the physical artifact?
No, the physical artifact now is a digital artifact.
Right.
And everyone has devices that can transfer the PDF onto the device. I'm kind of still old-fashioned, and environmentalists won't be very happy with me, but I then just print it out.
Right.
And I carry it around in my monocle bag, this very spacious bag.
I wonder, first of all, whether you read that first go at a manuscript with a pen in your hand, or whether you just read it as a punter might.
If I don't know the writer, if it's something that's an agent in the Senate, it's a new writer, I'll just sit and read it just to get it. Like I was saying about how it should write with a kind of momentum, that's how you should read it. Just very quickly get a sense of, oh, this is what this writer's doing. Because quite often the beginning may be kind of focused enough, but then as it gets on, you think, oh, this is what it's about. Oh, this is really interesting. My assumptions about what was going on, no, it's different. It's really interesting. If it's an author who I've had experience with publishing and editing, then when I start reading it, I'll have a pen there and just kind of, because I'm used to the kind of world that the writer, you know, is involved in. And your instincts about where something works or doesn't work are so fresh in that first reading that it's important just to make a little note to yourself.
Is there an idea of quality or an idea of how happy you are with a manuscript in terms of how many notes there are in the margin? I mean, as in terms of, I wonder when in the old days when we had homework that was marked, you know, you felt that you were going pretty strong if there were very few red marks on the page. Is that the case when you're looking at a manuscript, or might it just be tiny details or tiny clauses or something?
It depends on what the writer is trying to do. If they're trying to move beyond what they've done before, then you have to say, well, you'll probably likely make more marks, more interventions, because, oh, yes, this is where you're kind of feel safe with and comfortable with. This is where you're trying to do something different, and this doesn't work. But this other area you're going to, it does work. You know, so whereas, like if you're doing a crime novel, then there probably wouldn't be very many marks, because you said this person knows the genre, knows how it works. You know, there's a bit of dialogue that may be a bit clumsy, but like the last crime novel I edited, there weren't that many, you know, the odd sentence. Whereas with...
So genre novels kind of look after themselves a little bit more.
Yeah, that's right.
The whole sort of scenery, the sort of set design of it needs to move along speedily enough and in the right order. But the writing of it, it's not less important, but it's something that you are less likely to get your red pen to. Maybe.
Yeah, like our mutual friend Alex Preston, every novel he's written has been different.
Yeah.
He's pushing in a new direction. And so you have to be very careful to get a sense of where is he's going, and just making marks, well, this is in the right direction, this may not be.
Absolutely. You know, I'm just trying to think in my mind, the idea of a clean page, a clean, elegant page without marks being a successful page, that clearly doesn't have to be the case. You've got a beginning and an end there, and I know you wanted to sort of talk about that.
Well, yeah, I just, in fact, they're mainly beginnings, but just in some ways, the longest kind of time it takes when you approach a novel is just finding that first sentence, finding the voice of a novel. Like in Wolf Hall, what startled everyone by the book was she used the second person. You did this.
Yeah.
You were watching. You did this. It suddenly, nobody uses you. And normally in fiction, so it made it suddenly very, very different. So yeah, I just have three examples, because the first sentence should be make you want to know what the second sentence is. So one of them, this is a book by Sebastian Barry, Days Without End. The method of laying out a corpse in Missouri sure took the proverbial cake. And you think, oh, who's the corpse? Why are they Missouri? And who is it doing the laying out? Is he an undertaker? It turns out he's a soldier in this American Civil War. So again, that makes you think, what next?
Yeah.
The Beast by Paul Kingsnorth. I stood in the river up to my knees, and the river was cold. Now, why is someone standing in the river? And which river? And, you know, so again you say, what? And
I feel like this is in very short form, this is almost like a short story competition.
And then the last one is a Paul Auster's first novel, New York Trilogy. It was the wrong number that started it, the telephone ringing three times in the dead of night, and the voice on the other end asking for someone he was not.
There we are.
Who are they looking for?
And that's sort of classic noir right? That's what he was up to back in those days.
Yeah.
There are a million and one things we could talk about with this. I am glad that the manuscript still at least lands on your desk, Walter, with a wump, even if you have to take it away from the printer and do it yourself rather than it arriving airmail from New York City. But thank you for talking us through the highways and byways and the lack of red pen. About the editing process, but also about the manuscripts themselves. And this year, I wonder, how many do you think you will read? I mean, or next year in 2017, how many will come across your desk that you will take away to a cozy corner and read at the weekend?
Well, it's always every weekend. I mean, there's always, if there isn't anything set that I have to read that weekend, at 4:30 on Friday, there will be an email with a manuscript. So it's inevitable.
So there's always homework for someone.
It's always homework.
Walter, as ever, thank you very much for your time. Our final story today begins in Paris, where one duo's love of books spurred them to start a publishing house that specialises in the reproduction of the first drafts of classic novels. Jessica Nelson and Nicolas Tretiakov launched Éditions de Saint-Père in 2012 and have published beautiful editions of manuscripts by French authors such as Jean Cocteau and Voltaire. These glimpses into the minds of famous writers reveal scrap passages, the pressures of the creative process and relationships with publishers. Éditions de Saint-Père are just about to launch a series of English-language stories, starting with Charlotte Bronte's 1847 novel Jane Eyre, and Jessica Nelson came to the studio to tell producer Holly all about it.
About 10 years ago, we went to an exhibition, Nicholas is my partner, and it was an exhibition on drafts, on notebooks, on Moleskine, on the manuscripts, and we were so moved that we decided once we could, we would build a publishing company and really dedicated to this handwriting work. And so that's how it all started.
And you must have quite a good relationship now with lots of private collectors and libraries and museums around the world. What sort of conversations do you have to have with them, and what sort of research do you have to do to work out which manuscripts you're going to publish next?
You're right. We had to build these connections and these relations with the institutions as well as private collectors. At the beginning, they were a bit surprised because what we offer is quite new. It's not a facsimile, a classical edition, because we have special treatments with the images. We work on them as you would restore a painting, so that you get the feeling when you open one of our books that the writer has just written it and given the notebook to you. So it's really a wonderful sensation, wonderful feeling of intimacy with the writer that you get when you have one of our books.
You're about to launch your English series with Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose this book?
Well, first of all, we had started working with the British Library 2 years ago, and we had this great, relation with the BL and publishing Alice's Adventures Underground manuscript in France. And so it was very natural for us to continue talking and working with them. And one of the curators had told me that the Jane Eyre manuscript was one of their jewels, and it had never been published because there's some kind of a technical challenge here. And so we decided that since Jane Eyre was one of our, favorite books, it was perfect for us to start publishing English manuscripts with this one.
And you just showed me part of the book. I mean, it's huge because it's over 800 pages in the manuscript. And, it's really beautiful. You can see Charlotte Bronte's handwriting. You see where she's crossed things out, where there's smudges in the ink. What do you think people will learn about the story from reading these manuscripts that they don't already know?
Well, there are some passages that disappeared in the published edition. There you can really feel maybe the state of mind Charlotte Bronte was in when she knew she had to send the manuscript to Smith and Elder at that time, because they had refused her first novel, but they had sent a letter, a very nice letter, which encouraged her to send the next novel. And so really, we can imagine how she was paying attention to every detail, every sentence, the sound of each phrase. And there is this meticulosity. Sorry for the pronunciation, but I think you get it. She was very meticulous and very, very probably a bit stressed about how the manuscript would be received. And this is all these emotions that you get when you discover her manuscript. But it really, each adventure is different. We have several manuscripts behind us now, and For example, the manuscript of The Journey to the End of the Night is very scratched, very self-edited, and there you can see how Céline was working on his style. So each manuscript brings something different to you and tells you something different about each author.
And do you ever go back and read the actual books of these after you've read the manuscript? And do you take something different away from the story that you didn't take before?
Yes, probably you get the feeling that finally writers are geniuses, but also humans, and that the writing a book is not, or very rarely, but it's a lot of work. It's a lot of patience. It's a lot of endurance. And you can understand why writers are often people who suffer from that. It's so difficult. You could really see that also in the Jules Verne manuscript, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which we have published 3 years ago. He was really into his creative process and really, searching for the exact right word. And he knew he had to find the exact right word because he was addressing himself not only to an adult public, but also to the whole family. This was the goal of this book. It was to be a book of adventures for all the family. And so you can read between the lines what were the goals of the writers.
And do you ever have to consider when you're publishing these about whether the author would actually want people to see the first draft of their book?
You're totally right. I guess that some writers really would not appreciate us to discover the behind-the-scene thing. But none of the writers we've been publishing had expressed a no. So I don't feel too embarrassed.
I guess there's not much that many of them can do about it now.
No, there's not. But some of them, like Kafka, I think, expressed very clearly about that. He asked that the manuscript should be destroyed. But I think that the rights holder didn't respect his wish. So the manuscript are still existing now.
Can you take much from these to learn about the publishing industry as well? Does it tell a story of how the publishing industry has changed?
Yes, absolutely. In the case of the corrected proofs of The Flowers of Evil of Baudelaire, you can really see what was his relationship with his publisher. It's amazing. We didn't have the manuscript because he had moved so many times and he has written The Flowers of Evil during about 10 or 15 years before he started thinking about the publishing them. And in the corrected proofs, you will really understand how was the relationship between an author and his publisher. And it has really changed now. And so it's they are testimony of the past, absolutely, of the publishing industry, of how a manuscript was written and received and then acclaimed or not by the public.
That was Jessica Nelson, co-founder of Editions de Saint-Père. And if you want to get your hands on the beautifully packaged manuscript of Jane Eyre, then it will be released as a limited edition on December the 2nd. So why should we read manuscripts? Well, it's a little bit like going behind the scenes. These are texts that can reveal the creative process and the inner thinkings of an author's mind, but they can also tell a story that isn't on the page. As Christopher said at the top of the show, you don't have to be able to read the language. You can experience the history of these books by the weight of the vellum, the crack of the spine, and the notes in the columns. A little bit like the provenance of a painting, just where these books have travelled can sometimes tell a more fruitful story than simply what they're about. It's a romantic notion, but what will historians in hundreds of years to come be using to explore the tales of now? Words on a physical page seem to have more to say than in the digital ether. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was Holly Fisher. Of course, she's my editor too. Join me again at the same time next week when we'll be wondering whether the art biennial is getting out of control. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.